All lines are now bridged.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Conditions and Maintenance of Certification Requirements Task Force under the OMC CITES. We'll start off today's meeting with a brief roll call. Denise Webb.
Present.
Raj Rahmani.
Here.
Carolyn Peterson.
I'm here.
Ken Kalamoto, I believe, is still on vacation. Sasha Termont. Les Leonard. And John Travis?
Here.
Okay, maybe the others will join us here a little bit late, but why don't we get started just for a quick review of the charge. I'll hand it over to you, Kate.
Sure, thanks, Lauren. So, overview of the charge for the Conditions of Certification Task Force is to provide recommendations on the API real-world testing and attestations conditions of maintenance of certification requirements, any updates to the 2015 edition Health IT certification criteria, modifications to the ONC Health IT certification program, and deregulatory actions related to certification criteria and program requirements.
Thanks, Kate. And then today we're going to talk about we deferred the discussion on the four options that ONC wanted us to contemplate concerning the fire release version for the API for patients and populations requirement and for the consent management requirement, I believe. Oh, no, just for the API that's around the patients and populations. Requirement. So we were going to discuss that, and then we're going to talk about the modifications to the certification program, particularly around some corrections and principles of proper conduct for the accrediting bodies. So let's, I think you have a couple slides, Kate. Want to pull up the slide related to the API criterion? So this relates to adopting the new API criterion that would become part of the 2015 edition-based EHR definition, and it supports the two types of API-enabled services, services for single patient data and services for multiple patients' data. And on pages 211 through 214, there's a discussion in the preamble on four options. The actual regulation text proposes option one, which is to adopt fire release two for the proposed regulation. And we did have some discussion on this, and there were some emails, and I don't know, John, if you're comfortable to give us a summary or if any of the ONC folks would of the differences between the options and some of the nuances of selecting one over the other.
Yeah, and I saw Sasha joined, and she might be able to speak as well. I think the main thing I'd say in is the R4 version offers a lot for a good industry starting point going forward, and I know there was some exchange we had over the after our session last week on what, well, actually, I guess leading up to it, on what normative meant to the industry, and you know, conceptually, that really speaks to it being a validated and accepted standard, so it's really fairly literally descriptive of the standards process. And then there are some resources within it that have also reached normative status. But it's better positioned for some of the use cases that are important to the rulemaking from what I heard from our API services team. I'm speaking of R4, should have prefaced that.
Mm-hmm.
For bulk data, bulk data use cases, would be the best way to say it, and it also would be a good normalized basis for vendors to be on the same standard, because we saw it several places in the proposed rule, proposals of different versions for different purposes, and although not all of them are required, and by this I mean the data segmentation for privacy criteria in G11 was R3, we felt like being on a common basis and not having different versions in use across different criteria and different use cases would be very helpful to vendor development. So those are some of the higher level thoughts that I looked at, and I'm going to look at the other information that I have to see if there's anything further to highlight, but I think that was the gist of the feedback. And so if Sasha's on, she could elaborate further.
And just to refresh everyone that's on the phone, option two was adopting fire release 2 and 3. Option 3 was to adopt fire release 2 and 4. And obviously option 4 is to just stick with 4. So, Sasha, are you on the line?
Hello, yes. Sorry, yes. I was a couple minutes late.
You want
I agree
to
with,
add to this?
I think John gave a great summary. I think, like John said, our recommendation would be to adopt R4, and that's what we're hearing from the industry. It has support of, for example, the focus of the Argonauts group at the moment. Mm-hmm. There's enough technical differences between DSU2, which has the current, I think, most widespread adoption, and R4, that it makes sense to kind of focus future-facing development on R4 and not split effort between ongoing work on 2 or 3 and 4, which are a bit different in the technical details. And so I think the sort of feeling is that to position ourselves going forward, R4 will be the most effective and the best area to focus.
So I'm just curious for anybody that can answer this. As I was reading about the data segmentation and how SAMHSA has built that off of their app and spec off of Fire Release 3, does it, if we recommended going to 4, would that also, would 4 address the needs for the data segmentation as well? Or what about that? Would there be an issue?
Well, I guess I'll offer a couple of perspectives. First is my understanding is that the consent to share is less standard than it is a reference implementation and a guiding document for that particular approach. So it's a fairly specific use of the API standards and specifications and for the consent resource. I couldn't comment well enough as to whether or not there's any disruption caused or loss of capability by going to R4 as the basis for that. They just didn't work with it in terms of the consent to share effort. I'd also observe that's not a required criteria in terms of it being part of the base EHR or linked to the definition of certified EHR technology. That's not to downplay it, but it still is a discretionary item. So a little bit of proper, give it its proper regard and on that basis is probably not the reason to make the broad decision.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, surely the community would have time to start working with release 4 so that at
yeah, and
some
I think
point
the other observation made, I know our folks highlighted it, is the DSTU is several years old now, and the industry in a lot of ways progressed past it, and part of the normalized meaning for R4 from my team, they share with me that the data typing is normative, and there just is a lot better opportunity for a go forward position for interoperability for API based services and use cases using R4.
So what about option 3 that suggests adopting both 2 and 4? It, when you said a number of entities, vendors have adopted fire release 2 into their products. What do you all think about that? And what would be the biggest downside of doing 2 and 4 besides having to maintain code to support both?
I think, Denise, the downside is maintaining code to support both, including one standard that has LACE capabilities and is several years old. What's the advantage of supporting 2 and 4 instead of just 4?
Well, and the other thing to consider is that while that statement is true that, you know, I know a pretty significant majority of vendors adopted aspects of the DSTU to support the consumer use cases that were part of the 2015 edition when it came out several years ago. Not all did. We're dealing with provider use cases as well, which, you know, may have been fairly open to other development. And there will be gap development for all vendors to invest in to deal with the new requirements of the US CDI that were not part of this common clinical data set in terms of outright new development. And I think, you know, again, vendors prefer to be on a more progressive basis of standard that's still considered in a largely normative status for a lot of key elements of it going forward. So,
well, can anyone speak to the specific impact? I mean, obviously, I most recently came from an organization that had a homegrown system and also had a commercial system in the hospitals. But can anyone speak to the particular impact of one over the other of these for the provider organization on the implementation side and production operational side? Is there any nuances to be aware of?
Denise, when I talk to folks, I don't think there would be a sort of like implementation difference between the two standards. I suppose to some extent there might be some amount of additional complexity if 2 standards are supported, just like the development would be more complex if 2 standards are supported. But I don't think that providers will find it particularly harder or easier to roll out 2 versus 4. 4 might enable more capabilities, right? So from the perspective that both patients or provider users might be able to have more sophisticated applications that take advantage of the resources, 4 would offer that advantage.
Mm-hmm. Raj, do you have any particular perspective, or Carolyn?
I guess I'm just sitting here trying to rack my brain for who would really be affected. You know, thinking in terms of large groups, what sorts of folks would be affected if we drop 2 or recommend that 2 is dropped, and individuals, companies, whatever, have to make that sudden jump to 4. You know, who are we leaving behind if we get rid of 2?
Carolyn, I don't think it's fair to characterize it as a sudden jump, because the nature of this proposal is to say that 24 months from the publication of the final rule, we would have transitioned from whatever API standards are in use today to the new standards. That seems to give plenty of lead time for anyone who would be programming in this space to be adopting the first normative version of the standard.
Okay, well, even if it's not a sudden jump, maybe that's not a good term, but still, the question I have is who is actually affected? You know, what kinds of people are we talking about? Are we talking about large vendors or smaller firms that have developed apps for their particular user set, or who's really affected if we advocate dropping 2?
Well, it's interesting because I'm on the Chime Policy Steering Committee, and I know Liz Johnson and a number of the CIOs seem to be concerned about, or I shouldn't say number, there were a number that were pushing to go to release 4, especially the CIO from Rush, Dr. Rob. He, you know, of course, he's on the cutting edge of things. But I think they were having some of those reservations, Carolyn, to understand who's going to be left behind if we went with 4. So I know they were having the same discussion. I personally think that we shouldn't stymie the industry, and we would be disadvantaging ourselves as provider organizations, you know, that I've been a part of, if we didn't encourage or allow the vendors to be able to develop to a more current standard.
Well, I don't.
And I really, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I don't think that you'd want to block them from going up to four if they wanted to. I think my concern is more situations, organizations that function on a fairly limited scale, where they have something developed that's working well for their particular users. It's not necessarily creating a problem for them in not having that upgraded to four or rebuilt up to four. What does it mean for them if only four is adopted? That's all. I mean, obviously, for major vendors, the push is always going to be to innovate and to try to enhance and do things that allow you to do more. But sometimes small subsets of the very large population have particular uses where they don't have a problem and they're not looking to innovate anything more. They're just happy using what they have. And I'm just trying to get a sense of what the impact would be for those folks. That's all.
Yeah, this is Raj. I have a similar question. I think that if you ignore the issue of resources, there's no doubt that release 4 would be the obvious way to go. But I think thinking about potentially small to mid-sized developers that may have several things on their plate coming out of this rule, I'm not sure how many resources would be required for them to move from release 1 to 2 or 2 to 4. So if anybody has insight on that jump, and Sasha, to your point, I get that there's a long runway here, which is great, but I want to make sure that we're taking that into consideration with everything else that they may have to do that comes in this rule.
Well, I do think that it's clear that if the goal is to conserve resources, we shouldn't advance the standard, right? People have already made investments in DSTU2 that has the most current widespread adoption, both on the part of EHR developers, the implementers, right, health systems that have already posted their resources and their endpoints, and on the part of those who are currently building apps on top of those platforms. And if the goal is to sort of not invest more resources, then that would be the best path. But I think the consensus I'm hearing from the industry, and this is not limited to any one party, but is that there is interest in taking advantage of pushing the standard further. That's why folks have started to adopt DSTU3 in some cases. That's why folks are participating in standards groups that have created R4 and are pushing for R4 to be the adopted standard here. Adopting R4 is definitely more work for all parties. It is more work for, well, I don't know if it's more work for providers, actually, but it's more work for EHR developers to support. And then if apps want to take advantage of the features that are offered in R4, they have to do work on their end too. But I think that, you know, in the sense of, do we want to, not just now, but 3 years from now when this standard takes effect, still be using DSTU2 when better and more advanced standards have already been advanced by the industry? That seems kind of backwards from my perspective.
Well, I think the important point on this is that it's the point that Raj made about health IT developers that are smaller companies with fewer resources that want to compete in this market, and they might be lagging. And that does get addressed on 212, page 212, under the discussion of option 3. You know, if the majority of the industry is pushing towards 4, option 3 would allow them to continue. I don't believe, and Kate, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I don't believe if we recommended option 3 that developer organizations would be required to develop to release 2 and 4. And then this would preclude them having to due for pursuant to the standards version advancement process, which ONC said would not occur for about a year out, that this would be available.
Denise, would does that really solve the, I guess I'm just going to ask a devil's advocate question.
I'm just trying to get discussion going here to see if we can land somewhere.
Yeah. So what will drive what an app developer needs to develop is what resources are available for their app to use, right? So if some EHR developers adopt R4 under option 3, if an app developer still only supports 2, then their app still only works with some of the health systems, right? So I think option 3, while I guess if I understand it correctly, it permits EHR developers to choose between 2 and 4. I guess I think that's less desirable than option 4 personally, but
yeah,
I don't think it actually achieves the effect of helping app developers. Am I misunderstanding?
No.
No, this is Raj. I think you're laying out some very good, clear arguments for why release 4. What I'm grappling with is why would the proposed rule even offer option 3? Given that, to what you've just stated, you know, most of industry and everybody's participating in 4 and pushing for standards for 4. So what I'm trying to understand is they must have had some reason to provide option 3 rather than just trying to fill pages. So does anyone have an idea as to why? I'm thinking that they have some strategic reason there. And to your point, too, if the market is moving to 4, then it seems like option 3 would just get everybody to 4 as well. So I'm just trying to get as to why even have option 3 as a possibility.
I think if there's anyone from ONC that can speak to that, I don't know what that does to vendors. I mean, you're as an app developer, what does that do to you to deal with differences in the level that a API has evolved to from a standards perspective? I'm not sure I'm fluent enough to know that. It just seems like when you're on difference in standards, you're going to increase the work or the burden on the app developer that may work with both. I realize in a given instance, you may not face that. A vendor's going to make a choice. An implementing provider is going to really be kind of constrained to the vendor's choice unless they're doing their own development.
Well, here's a good question. What does it do to interoperability? I was wondering, is there so let's say health system A uses vendor A, who is on release 2, and health system B, who uses vendor B, is using release 4. Can interoperability occur between those two health systems if they want to share information, if they're on different releases of the fire standard? And I'm not technical enough to know the answer to that question in terms of APIs.
If they were both interacting with an application, let's call it like App Z, right?
Mm-hmm.
App Z would have to support both DSU2 and R4.
So the app would actually handle the translation between the two. Okay.
Potentially. I mean, I think that would be the determination the app developer would make.
Well, that creates another level of complexity for developers to have. I see the point about having to support both versions instead of driving everybody to 4.
Right. I think if we push for 4, then app developers don't have to handle that complexity, and instead they could rely on – it will be to app developers' advantage to have one standard, whether we picked 2 or 4, right? 4 is, I think, the better
choice.
Well,
it will be to the advantage of the customers who don't have to pay the additional cost of them having to develop and maintain the 2 standards. I mean, because that's what it ultimately comes down to, costing everybody more money. So how would this group feel about proposing or recommending and then having the broader committee discuss and, you know, having us bring this forth at the next meeting to recommend to go with option four.
This is Raj. I mean, I think it warrants further discussion. I think there's no doubt that everyone being on the same release would be beneficial, and I'm always for pushing for the latest release because that's where the industry should move anyways. The point that just gives me hesitation is the fact that the ONC is even putting this in as an option, which makes me think that there is some legitimate concern around some smaller size developers having a challenge getting to release four.
Carolyn, I agree.
I'd say you want probably, or we should ask, to, whether it's Mike Lipinski or somebody else from ONC, if they have their own grounding. I don't remember from the preamble if they get into that a lot. But that would be a good thing to ask of them. And then I think part of the perspective I'd offer you for smaller developers, they may be faced with significant new development. I hate to say it, Raj, but it might be a neutral effect on them to move to something they're not already on, regardless of where that sits. And they may be the ones who had a more focused development that stayed with doing only what they needed to do, given their size and their scale when they faced 2015 edition certification the first time. So I don't know if we know a lot about how much was done by that scale of vendor to address provider use cases. The bulk data is going to be probably entirely new. So I guess my point is they're going to have to move to a new basis of something. They might have been on a non-standard basis and are moving to Fire for the first time, at least for a significant chunk of their inventory. So those things all kind of speak to whatever they're doing something new. And it may be a fairly neutral factor for them to go to a given basis. So in a way, an argument for R4.
And when I'm thinking about patients and the number of patient-facing apps that are popping up, that patients can select their own app where they want to pull their data into, you know, a lot of those are entrepreneurial developers. They're not necessarily big companies that have the resources to support two standards to deal with in their app. So thinking about it from the patient app side, it really probably would be better if we're driving towards the more current standard.
Agreed.
So how would you all like to approach this in terms of a draft recommendation for further deliberation by the and guidance by our full committee when we present this next week?
I think it would be reasonable to say that we're all leaning toward release four, and it's hearing from the larger group whether they have any strong concerns with that, given that we're noting that there could be an impact on smaller developers.
Everybody good with that? I mean, it is not a final decision, so I think there's a lot of expertise on our committee, and the broader perspective would be worthwhile.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree. This is Sasha. I jotted it down. I've been taking notes on our conversation in the template from our previous API conversation, so I tried to put everyone's points and then this proposal into the notes there for our reference.
Thanks, Sasha. I appreciate that. By the way, is there just a link to that, and it's out on Google?
Yeah, I just went to that notes from 3.6 because that was when we had first talked about APIs and put them in there at the bottom.
Okay. All right, great. Thanks. Just want to make sure I can find it after. All right, any other discussion on these four options? If not, we can move ahead to the rest of our agenda. Raj, I don't know if you wanted to take the lead on the next agenda item. I know you were away, so I don't know.
Yeah, I have been away, and I haven't looked over these things, so if you don't mind driving it, that would be great.
Sure. Okay. If we could go to the next slide. And before we launch it into this, and I'll probably have you, Kate, give us a summary, but I noted on our agenda that, or originally, that there were two areas we had to address: corrections and principles of proper conduct. Let me get to my page here. Kate, for the corrections, is that under Section 5 in the preamble, modifications to the ONC Health IT Cert program? Corrections around auditable events and tamper resistance, and then amendments?
Yes, there should be four of them, the VDT.
Do you download and transmit to third parties? Because I know this slide doesn't talk about the corrections. Do you want to, or could you give a summary of the corrections and then see if, then we can have some discussion? I think the other one is mandatory disclosures and certifications are the four. Those were the four.
Sure. So I'll start with the corrections. A number of these were items left over from before that didn't make it into RegTex, but that we had previously. We may not need to spend a whole lot of time on them.
I didn't think previous, so.
We've previously corrected these. The majority of these in our sub-regulatory guidance. So we can, again, it's like there was a cross-reference in the auditable events and tamper resistance that we corrected in the amendments. Go back up here.
I think on the amendments, what was a problem there is the amendment certification criteria was being applied to capabilities that didn't necessarily have any patient data that would request an mm-hmm. amendment. So you all corrected that.
And then the third was the VDT. And then the last one was just integrating the privacy and security certification framework, basically updating that based on prior changes that we had made that was included in this section.
So for the task force, are there any comments or concerns about the corrections? I think it's fairly straightforward.
Not for me.
I think it's fine.
Good.
Yeah. I don't have anything.
Carolyn? Okay, good. Well, we hit an easy point. That's great. Okay, Kate, do you want to just summarize on the changes for the principles of proper conduct that we're going to deliberate on?
Sure. So the slide that's up goes over updates to the principles of proper conduct for the ONC ACBs. The ONC ATLs, the proposed change, was one of the same as the ONC ACBs with regard to the records retention, which was mainly a clarification. So on this slide here, we have what the ONC ACBs, these are new requirements, the first six here, that they must accept test results from any ONC ATL in good standing, review and confirm health IT developer submission of real-world testing plans and results and make them publicly available, collect developers' quarterly attestations, and note in the chapel when the modules are updated under the standards version advancement process, ensure that health IT developers seeking to take advantage of the standards version advancement process flexibility comply with applicable requirements, retain the records of the timing and content of the developer's notices and post each notice's content publicly on the chapel. Review and submit health IT developers' condition and maintenance of certification attestations, and then report to ONC any information that could lead ONC to perform direct review. Some new flexibilities. The role of the ONC AA would be eliminated, and we go into more detail on that in the deregulatory actions. Certain randomized surveillance requirements would be eliminated. ONC ACBs would be able to certify health IT modules that they evaluated for conformance with certification criteria without first passing through the ONC ATL, as long as the conformity methods were approved by the national coordinator. And then two other items no longer required are the disclosure requirements and transparency attestations regarding the sharing of information in the mandatory disclosures. And those two items are also included in the deregulatory action section of the preamble.
All right. So if we can open the floor for discussion on any of these items, or we can have a shorter meeting and go to public comment if you don't have any particular concerns. I thought most of this was very straightforward and was going to reduce some burden, not on just the ACBs, but as well as the health IT developer entities.
So the only question that I had as I was thinking about it, and I agree, Denise, generally with your assertion that it seemed very reasonable, I started to think about the records retention requirements for ONC ACBs and ONC ATLs that's proposed. And it's tied to when ONC removes an applicable addition from the Code of Federal Regulations, which at first glance I was like, well, okay, that makes sense, right? When the ONC 2011 edition was removed from the regulation, then records retention after, is it 3 years, I think?
3 years, yeah.
Isn't pertinent any longer. When ONC 2014 edition is retired, which is just been happening now, then 3 years from now, records retention doesn't matter. But it started to make me think about the overall way in which ONC is approaching certification and addition versioning now, because I think that the changes that are proposed here are pretty significant, but they're proposed as changes to the ONC 2015 edition rather than as a new applicable edition, which obviously has other implications, which I don't know if our work group should discuss that or others. I think that merits a larger discussion, certainly. But one of the implications of not creating a new edition, but instead proposing this as a modification to a previous edition, is that it certainly affects how we have to think about any flow-down effects on things tied to an applicable edition, because records retention in this case isn't being sort of updated. I guess I'm just thinking, if for the next 10 years ONC just keeps updating the ONC 2015 edition, then I have less confidence that this is an appropriate way to do records retention. I think it should just be tied to a calendar date or age or something. Then if I feel that the applicable edition would be routinely updated every 4 to 5 years with a new edition and old editions being correspondingly retired. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that you make a really good point. As I was listening to you, I was wondering what is the criteria for deciding that there would be, let's say, a 2019 edition?
Right.
And maybe it has to stand on its own as its own rule. I don't know. Lauren or Kate, do you have anything to clarify as far as what the criteria is that ONC uses to decide to publish a new edition versus just modifications to an edition?
So for this, at least for this proposed rule, we obviously didn't come up with a brand new edition for 2019. We went with like updating the 2015 edition, modifying that, you know, not trying not to tie that to a specific year. But beyond that, you know, I don't have anything else to offer other than, you know, like we proposed the modification to the 2015 edition for the record retention instead of the new, you know, coming out with a whole new edition and trying to update that for, you know, every, you know, 2 years or every so many years.
Well, I think Sasha makes a really great point about the methodology for the records retention. It doesn't seem to make sense if I mean, because think about how old the 2015 edition is already now, just when you think about when it first came out, proposed rule, and when it was final. What do others think? Carolyn, do you have any thoughts on this, or Raj? John?
Yeah, I have, you know, I'm trying to recall, and this may be an entirely stupid question, but is the record retention retroactive to the start of the 2015 edition, or is it with the effective date of the final rule and applying to anything going forward? Does anyone recall? I do have some other comments.
Well, I think originally it was the life of the edition, which begins with the codification of an edition or certification criteria.
So it would be retroactive given that.
Sounds like it. That's my understanding, John. I mean, if you're already preserving for the life of the 2015 edition.
Yeah.
And then
The other thing, and I don't know that it gets into a great amount of descriptive information, is just what are the documents subject to being retained? Because I can think of a lot of different things that pertain to that. So currently, you know, what that would tell me are the things that we maintain to be our basis of doing the quarterly reporting that we do. Now, our ACB is Drummond. We do a quarterly reporting to them for surveillance purposes on, you know, any software changes and any material things that need to be reported to them for their review. We get into product update situations. I'm sure those things. I'm just curious if there is a better articulation, because obviously the ACB retains a lot of records as well.
John, it does say the final, the 2015 edition final rule specified ACBs to retain all records related to certification of complete EHRs and health IT modules.
Yeah, and I know what those would be. I think from the vendor's perspective, it's probably more the open question of, is it the parallel to that, or is it something more comprehensive?
Well, and there is a separate provision so the two provisions in this section that we're technically focused on now are for ACBs and ATLs. There's a separate provision for health IT developer.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm getting out of bounds a little bit.
Yeah, and I think all of them have, in my mind, they all have this same question, which also in my mind, I guess, is a little bit bigger. I guess I'm questioning the decision to make fairly significant changes to certification without tying it to a new edition.
Yes, I would. So maybe if we switch focus a little bit to that, I mean, there's a number of questions, and some of them are fairly tactical, but the ONC Chapel has not exactly flourished with high usability for its ease of use, the ease of search, distinguishing information. It's gotten better, but we're introducing changes that largely are in place and are going to be staggered, and in many cases are going to probably require maintenance of current listings and new listings. And you know, if I'm a Chapel user, I'm probably going to really struggle with differentiating things. And a lot of things are going to have to be done to convey to me things like, you know, as the vendor increments standards or as the vendor achieves certification of a newer capability, maintaining access to older listings that are still effective that the vendor intends to have maintained, the potential for confusion is significant, I think. And we haven't seen exactly a plan for how that gets maintained, but I know ONC speaks to, like identifying standards that a vendor has enabled capability to that are higher than the specification version that's contained in the criteria, but you've got a lot to convey through the same basis of addition for product listings that are going to create differentiation that we really haven't seen how that's to be done.
Hey, John, I don't think there's anything that precludes us from making a recommendation, an overhead recommendation that reflects this discussion, because, as I'm listening to both of you and I'm thinking about this and I I've been out on the chapel and it can be very confusing, and there's some pretty broad sweeping significant changes to the 2015 edition as a result of this rule. So I don't know, as a basic user of the chapel, I would be very confused about, which version of the 2015 edition are we talking about here? I don't know. I would think it's even difficult for the federal government to keep track of it if it's just going to be 2015 edition and some.
I agree. I mean, date. I think it's a broad recommendation to say this should be designated in some manner overall as a distinct criteria. All right, I'll say it, addition or sub-addition.
I would say that we should recommend that it be a new addition. I mean, it has implications, and we can describe that in our recommendation around the records retention, some of the things that Josh has said.
I'd say two or three things that, we could certainly enumerate a list of the areas that are going to need to be, visible and accessible in terms of understanding through the chapel, but let me give you a couple. So, in one case, the current basis of export is being removed as of the effective date of this final rule, and they're introducing a new one at some point over the following 2 years. So, that's a distinction, but yet they're maintaining for the API services G8 through that same 2 year period while vendors are expected to certify to G11. So you're introducing substantive difference in capability apparently underneath the same listings, but kind of in different ways and at different scales. And there's a number of things like that, the standards advancement process, how that is to be communicated and designated, differentiating, certifying to the quality measure criteria because you're replacing the standard for C3, but, otherwise, how am I to know how that appears? So,
you as a vendor and the ACB have to retain all the records related to those things that are removed because the addition was not sunset. Just
correct.
The requirement with sunset. Okay. Raj and Carolyn, any thoughts on this, or do you think this is a good point to make?
Yeah, I think it's a good point to raise. I don't have any other thoughts on this particular issue.
Yeah, I'm with Raj on that. I'm listening to the discussion and thinking we probably need the broader airing.
Yeah, it does. It's sort of an umbrella recommendation because it does have legs. the not doing this and staying with the 2015 edition and just modifying that nomenclature. Okay, anything else that stands out for any of you on the principles of proper conduct for ONC ACB?
When appropriate, I want to have a brief discussion on the randomized surveillance piece.
I think that's a separate section, right?
Yeah.
So I have a comment on it also. In this section, I was curious, so there's a, ONC proposes that there could be certain methods of conformity that would be presented to ACBs rather than ATLs. Is that in this section, or am I?
Say that again, Sasha. There's a what?
Okay, so it's under this in the slide. It's under new flexibilities for ONC ACBs, number 3.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't actually understand what that meant. Could maybe someone from ONC give an example of what's envisioned?
Sasha, are you talking about in the lighter blue box, number 3?
Yes. What is that?
So that's in, if you look on the preamble on page, let me just pull it up here. Okay, so it's on page 122.
Okay.
Of the preamble.
I don't think it explains what it means there, though.
So basically, we're proposing, so in certain circumstances, allowing an ONC ACB to certify health IT that did not necessarily go through the ONC ATL, as long as it's been approved by the national coordinator.
So there would be no testing lab involvement, and there would be some other type of evidence?
It
says at the bottom of the page, however we propose, there has to be some method of determining conformity, but that method would have to first be approved by the national coordinator. So they are envisioning some other method of conformancy evaluation other than testing through the lab. And it's not descript.
Yeah, I guess I found it intriguing as a proposal, but I didn't really understand what was envisioned. If there are specific examples of what's hoped to be implemented under this provision, or if it's trying to open up a particular new opportunity, I just didn't. And then I guess, of course, I couldn't really respond because I didn't know exactly what to picture.
So think about what I was thinking on this, because if you look at the next page, that they're saying they're acknowledging the broad spectrum of evidence of conformance that can occur. So like in real-world testing or actual use of, let's say you put something out in beta, it's not certified, you're trying to work through it. I mean, there might be other, I think what they're trying to acknowledge is there. Not everything necessarily has to go through a lab for testing, that there could be evidence elsewhere that proves that your module conforms to the requirements. But they want to see what that is first and approve that method before they allow the ACB to implement that.
Okay.
And I actually think that's a good thing for the developers. It does create flexibility.
I was very intrigued by it. I just didn't know what it was.
Now, I know some of the things here we're going to touch on tomorrow on the deregulatory.
I think that's where the surveillance piece that Raj mentioned is, and I had some feedback on that also. Do we want to continue to that now or just adjourn earlier?
I mean, we could knock it out now.
The surveillance piece is listed as number 2 on the lower light blue box.
Right, and
but
it's
also
on
have
the deregulatory text. It's on, I'll tell you where it is.
39, I think.
Yeah, 39
and 40. 39. Yep, 39 and 40. Is that okay, Lauren and Kate, if we talk about that? Get ahead of ourselves here. If we're finished with modifications.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine from my perspective, as long as you're all set.
Sure, and I just sent out the Google Doc for the deregulatory actions, too.
Okay. All right, so it sounds like we've concluded our discussion on the modifications and that we could start some discussion on our next topic that was scheduled for tomorrow on deregulatory actions, starting with removal of randomized surveillance requirements. So Raj and Sasha, Raj, you have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, I want to just raise the general piece about removing the 2% requirement for randomized surveillance up for discussion. And in particular, what I would like to see if we could do is get some more data from the ONC, if they're able to share it, on when those randomized surveillance, when randomized surveillance occurs, what percent of those result in the identification of nonconformities? Because I think the reasoning behind removing this makes sense, is they want to reduce the burden that's put on providers and others by doing the randomized surveillance. However, if those events, if a good number of those events are turning up nonconformities, then I think it's important to keep that 2% and maybe even consider whether that number needs to be increased depending on the nonconformities that are being identified. Thoughts on that?
Well, we've been through that a number of times. I think where, you know, if I recall, and this was in the discussion, if you noted, and it's noted at the bottom of page 39 about, or actually top page 40, when they exercised enforcement discretion, I think they stated a lot of their reasons. Maybe they didn't give statistics per se, but they stated a lot of their reasoning about the value of randomized surveillance and the burden that it put on providers. And I think there was a lot of skepticism about the ability of providers to really participate in that, fully understanding of what its intent was, and a lot of confusion about just what was being asked. You know, Sasha and I both, I'm sure, could share similar experiences of trying to help clients understand what was being asked of them, because there was engagement with the HIT vendor to help kind of serve a bit of a translation, if you will, or some kind of supportive role to make sure that the surveillance instruments and things like that. We went through with both ICSA and Drummond, and there was a lot of effort on our part to try to make sure the questions being asked were understandable, or the survey procedures, or, you know, witnessed walkthroughs were understood, because it that was hard to get to. I think that was very, very challenging for the ACBs to put into place methods and instruments that would be well understood and accurately answered, if you will. The other thing, Raj, think about is that I got to believe real-world testing is almost a direct replacement for it in a way, because that is exactly the kind of thing that was attempted through randomized surveillance, and maybe not even to that point. And it puts the vendor in the position of having to take more responsibility for proving out the real weight of their capability for what is now the high priority criteria. If you remember, randomized surveillance was focused on, you know, a certain subset of what we're seeing as high priority items, and that has been ingested into the real world testing proposals. So, you know, I think because that could also involve provider participation, there's a balance of trying to not put too much burden on the providers to have to participate in both of those activities as a kind of a standing requirement that's not complaint driven.
I'm going to concur with John. I mean, coming from a provider organization and having previously been the state health IT coordinator for Wisconsin, and hearing the number of concerns that providers had around wanting their when they raised an issue that a product was not conforming to the certification as advertised, they are much more interested, and I would be, in the reactive surveillance, meaning that I've identified something in, as a provider organization, and I want the ACB to investigate it and check into it and get a remedy, versus coming and occupying our resources and time to look at something on a random basis to find nothing is a waste of our time. So, I mean, that would be my position on it.
Yeah, I think those are good points. I mean, I think coming back to John's comment, I'm not sure that real-world testing actually gets at this, because the real-world test focuses specifically on interoperability and may not touch some of these other issues. Denise, to your point, I agree. We never want to place burden on any stakeholder, whether it's a vendor, provider, or other, unnecessarily, and that's why it sort of asked for data on this. The challenge with waiting for a reactive is that the issue has already occurred. You know, it's sort of just like a reactive approach to safety. You never want to just rely on a reactive approach to safety because that means somebody's already probably been harmed or that hazard's already been identified with the potential for harm. So I think the motivation for having a randomized surveillance program is you're sort of incentivizing everybody to make sure that there are no nonconformities. So I kind of see the logic for that. But if there are data here to help this, and if it is the case that hypothetically out of 100 randomized surveillance activities, they find 1% of nonconformities, well, sure, certainly then it makes sense to remove that, I think. So if there are data available, I think that can help inform the discussion.
Yeah, Raj, I think, sorry. I was just going to respond to the comment on the focus is the real world testing compared to the prioritized criteria areas. I think in the balance to give just a review of that statement, Raj, ONC is proposing to retire a number of criteria that may be a part of that, and definitely there were some of the interoperability criteria were also a part of that. Things like quality measure criteria, transition of care, things of that nature. So I would invite, given weight to that statement or evaluation, that statement in light of the current proposals for ONC retiring criteria and shifting others into the real-world testing to see if they still are included in something that is, shall we say, field-based, to really kind of give some judgment of that.
I actually have a different comment. And I certainly, if someone from ONC has the data that Raj is interested in, I would find that very interesting as well. My proposal is that if this is implemented, maybe pending the data that Raj requested, the proposal does not make sense to me as it's given. So the way that they're proposing to implement it in the regulatory text is that instead of saying ONC ACBs must conduct this testing, they say they may conduct the testing, then they would remove the requirement to do it for 2% minimum, remove the requirement regarding selected locations, and also, and this is the part I don't understand, remove the requirement that you're prohibited from consecutively selecting for randomized surveillance the same HIT module more than once during any consecutive 12-month period. And if they say that ONC ACBs still may conduct this, they're just not required to, it doesn't seem like we should retire the prohibition against consecutive selection, because if an ACB decided to continue to do randomized surveillance, perhaps they found that it was an effective method per Raj's suggestion about data, they should still be prohibited from consecutively randomly selecting the same HIT product more than once in a 12-month period.
Yeah, Sasha, I think that's a great point. I think that's an odd restriction there.
Is it okay if I make a recommendation in our notes that if this whole provision is implemented, that we recommend not removing the prohibition on consecutive selection?
I would agree, because then one vendor's particular module could become subject to frequent, within a 12-month period, frequent.
Yeah,
surveillance.
I agree.
And that doesn't seem proper.
No, I mean, that's why they had it before.
I'm misunderstanding off of Denise's latest comment. Are we saying that an ACB should be able to?
No.
No, what?
They should not. They should not. So what Sasha's saying, do not require the requirement that limits the number of times that the same IT module can be surveilled. So if this is implemented, the ACB may, on it of its own discretion, still randomly surveil. But their randomness cannot result in hitting the same IT module more than once in 12 months if we don't allow, or if we recommend to ONC that they do not retire this requirement, which I agree with Sasha. They should not retire it if they're going to allow ACBs at their own discretion to randomly surveil. They're just not going to require it anymore. They should not retire this requirement, is what we're saying. Are you following that, Raj?
Slightly.
Okay.
I have the language, if I could project, or if you want to look at it in the Google Docs, it might be easier to understand looking at the regulatory language.
Yeah, thank you. I can also pull up the email with that. I think that minus the regulatory language, it seems like if you're randoming, I think they should be able to randomly surveil if they determine that that's important to do. And in that randomness, if they do hit the same vendor again, I would say they should be able to surveil, to investigate, for lack of a better term, if there were non-conformities that were found on the previous occurrence.
Well, that would be reactive surveillance, not randomized surveillance, Raj.
They still can do that.
Why would that be reactive? So I'm saying if they act to randomize surveil and they find a non-conformity, and then they randomly surveil again and they happen to stumble upon the same vendor, history should matter.
Well, I think we're talking about different things. It could be part of finding one non-conformity that you were going to surveil that product again. And that would not be randomized surveillance. That would be reactive surveillance based on the first finding of a non-conformity. The randomized surveillance would say you surveilled product A in January and found nothing, presumably, and then you randomly, 2 months later, of all the products out there to randomize surveil, try to do product A again. And that, I think, is inappropriate, right?
Yeah,
wait at least 12 months before randomizing product A a second time. If you found something, then it would be fine to do reactive surveillance on the same product.
Which they can do. And that would, and this requirement wouldn't prohibit that.
Yep,
right.
This is the...
So what they're proposing is to change the must word that is currently in the regulation to be may instead. So it would still be allowed if an ACB wants to. It's just not required. Then ONC proposes to axe what's in 2, which I have in red, because that requires 2%, and that was what Raj asked for data about. And then scrolling further down, ONC proposes to get rid of both 5 and 6 also. Five is about how to select sites. If this is no longer required, then 5 doesn't seem necessary. They can select sites based on their own preferences. 6 says, if you are doing this, you can't pick the same HIT product more than once during any 12-month period. And that's what I'm saying. This 6 should stay, even if if it changes to may instead of must, and 2 and 5 go away.
And it even says it does not apply to reactive and other forms of surveillance required under this subpart. So it gives
exactly
them the option, Raj, if they did a random on a health IT module, they found something, then they decide we're going to go back and verify through reactive surveillance that that was really taken care of, or that they're not still operating with a problem.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. How are we doing on time? Lauren, what time is public comment?
Just about 7 minutes at 10:20.
Okay. All right. And Kate, did you take an action to see if that we could get some more data around?
Yeah, Chris is going to follow up on that.
Yeah, I can.
Okay.
I can certainly.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, I can do that.
All right. All right, anything else on this? Well, since we're in here, we have a few minutes. Maybe we could do number two, removal of the 2014 edition from the Code of Federal Regulations.
I wouldn't think that one's controversial since it's not a referenced edition after a date already passed relative to 2019 program requirements, we know.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Of course, it'll be concerned for entities that only have a 2014 edition.
Well, it's other things that make that concerning for them, actually, like CMS regs.
Yeah, yes. The only thing I can think of that we ran across, but I don't think it would come into play by timing when this final rule comes out, is there is a reference to the 2014 edition that's rather hardwired in the current chronic care management program that operates under the physician fee schedule, and it runs on a year that goes July 1 to June 30th, as I recall. So we're actually kind of in a straddle right now, but I think that's going to be water under the bridge before any final rule comes out, and that they would address that in the 2020 physician fee schedule rulemaking.
All right. The next is the removal of the ONC approved accreditor from the program.
So is this, just for my clarity, is the ONC approved accreditor ANSI?
That was my understanding.
Hey,
that's what I thought. I'm just trying to make sure I'm understanding.
Yeah, that's correct. The current accreditor is ANSI.
I didn't have a great understanding of what this meant. The accreditation process that happens between ANSI and the ACBs is not something I have a lot of insight into as a participant in the certification process. So, I think it would be feedback from maybe the approved entities that would weigh me one way or the other. I don't know enough about this part of the process.
I mean, I read through this and I didn't have any particular concerns. I thought it made sense to reduce the bureaucracy around this and provide the ACBs the ability to maintain their accreditation through existing bodies, standards bodies. So they just need to obtain accreditation, and then they can obtain it from any body that is a signatory to the multilateral recognition arrangement with the International Accreditation Forum, which is a pretty known group. They just have to obtain and maintain accreditation to the ISO/IEC 17065. Yeah, and I'm not knowledgeable on all of these things either, but it made sense. Other comments? Okay. The next item is removal of certain 2015 edition certification criteria and standards. Go ahead.
Oh, you want to go to public comment?
Yeah, I was just going to say, since this has a number of items that might generate some discussion, maybe we should go to public comment.
Sure.
Thanks. We'll just give time to pull up this slide here. Okay, perfect. And then, operator, can you open the public line?
Yes, thank you. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad, and a confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Okay. And then Kate and Denise and Raj, it just occurs to me, since we're a little bit ahead of schedule, maybe for our next meeting, we will just kind of briefly recap the discussion today and then kind of dive into the next topic, just so that members of the public who are following don't kind of get off schedule from what we've posted in terms of our timeline of topics.
That sounds fine, and I think probably since this next part has a lot of pieces, we should just hold it till tomorrow.
Okay. Let's see. Operator, do we have any comments in the queue at this time?
There are no comments at this time.
Okay. So I'll hand it back to you guys just to kind of wrap up this portion, and then we will adjourn after that.
Okay. So I don't know if you want to take the lead tomorrow. We can talk about that after, Raj. But we'll finish the deregulatory. We'll summarize what we talked about today on the deregulatory actions as the first part of the meeting tomorrow, and then finish going over the rest of these removals. Just for the rest of the task force, Kate and I had discussed in the debrief meeting on Friday, she's starting to pull together from our notes in our Google Docs and our, you know, various discussions, the themes around our recommendations to present at the meeting in Washington next week. And what we'll do is we'll circulate these to the entire task force via email to make any type of comments, or we can actually put them out on the Google Drive so that you can make your comments right in there in the document that's going to be used to create the slides next week. Did I reflect that correctly, Kate, on what we're doing?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay.
And I just wanted to, since we discussed API slightly today, I just wanted to remind everyone that there's a, well, we meet tomorrow morning, so I'll send another reminder, but there's the API webinar this week, March 13th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time.
Thanks, Kate. And that is public, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And do we have that registration or link on our website?
We do. It's on the healthit.gov/NPRM, right on the right-hand side is the link to registration.
Perfect. Thanks. Okay. Well, it sounds like maybe we could just get about 9 minutes back to our days. And then Kate, Denise, and Raj will just debrief shortly.
Sure. We'll dial in.
Okay.
Sounds
thanks,
great.
Everyone. We'll adjourn. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.